Okay, it's time for Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit, and I'm Dr. Lisa. Hey, how's it going? Yeah, I don't know. It's cold. It's cold out there. That's all I can think about right now. I'm waiting. We're all waiting for spring. But you know what? I wanted to share with you today. I was thinking, what am I going to talk about? And I wanted to share that I was thinking about my husband, because he's been like really, really cranky lately because he's under a lot of stress. And I wound up like getting really like, you know, just like, oh, I don't want to deal with this person anymore. And then all of a sudden, when I started thinking just like 20 minutes ago, what do I really want to let people know today? I was thinking, I want to let them know how much I appreciate my husband. Because, you know, there is so much great stuff that about him that I get from the relationship, all this stuff. And I wind up like feeling really like annoyed at him. And I forget that I actually should be grateful. So I'm using that to tell you folks that today is a day. Let's all remember the people that are important and do a lot for us that we never say thank you to. Thanks, Phil. Anyway, all right, enough. We'll have a fight later, I'm sure. So I've got an on-air read to share with you. Do you know that, you know, Radio Free Brooklyn has live shows? We have live, we usually have like one or two live shows a month, but we have one live music show first Thursdays at the Well. And tonight's the night. Tonight is the night. And we always have such a great time, and most of the, a lot of the, you know, hosts show up, and the bands are really great because we have so many music people. We know what the great good bands are, and good bands want to be part of Radio Free Brooklyn. So come to the Well tonight. Okay. It starts at 8. It's at the Well, which is 272 Meserole Street. Tickets are $10 in advance. Go to my Facebook page. You can get the link if you want. And I'm going to, here's the description. First Thursday at the Well, three different takes, exciting, expanding music scene, Brooklyn, post-punk band, Even Twice, Streep Throat after that, closing out the evening, Vereen in all their deviant glory. There, that's enough, right? You get it. You get it. Come on, it's going to be really fun. And we know you need some fun. What else are you going to do? You have no friends. Okay. So, anyway, thank you for listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. That's all I can say. So, I have a really, really, really interesting guest here today. His name is Oliver Wasow. Did I say your last name properly?
You did.
I was worried about that. So here's the thing. I'm just going to put this out there. All right. Oliver is, in my opinion, he probably won't agree with this, or he'll be modest about it, but he's very, 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 very well-known, high profile, well-respected. He's making faces in the art world. This is me, Oliver. This is not about you yet. This is all about you, but this part's about me.
Okay.
So Oliver, you know, I'm afraid that like some really big names, I'm not even going to mention them, but they know who they are. They're friends with Oliver, or even his gallerist who I adore, Stephanie Theodore, who's I consider a friend. Stephanie, are we friends? I think you would say so. I'm like a little afraid because they know, you know, I don't know. I'm afraid people might be listening, and I don't ever, who knows if that ever happens. So the reason Oliver's here today in particular is because he has a show on right now and at 56 Bogart. You take the L train to the Morgan stop, and it's right across the street at Theodore Art. It's a fabulous, fabulous, fabulous show. The exhibition is up till April 22nd. And you can also, you'll hear a little bit more about his work, but he's also going to be setting up a portrait studio in the gallery, and you can have a portrait done by him if you get in contact with Stephanie at 212-966-4324. Oliver is also going to be having a book coming out soon called Friends, Enemies, and Strangers. And the information when they have the date and the location will be on my Facebook page in the next few weeks. Hello, Oliver.
Hello.
So, Oliver, your work is so complicated for me to explain. There's like about a million different bodies of work. This is what I thought I would do to introduce your work. I'm going to read you the titles. I'm going to read you, folks, not Oliver. I'm going to read you the titles of his bodies of work on his website, and then he's going to try to describe it a little bit. Okay, so it's called, I'm just going to do this like a poem, all right? Hoover, buildings and landscapes, travel pictures, interiors, exteriors, flight, portraits. But rogues, artist unknown, and his commercial work. Okay, Oliver, tell us what the hell is your work about, or tell us about the process a little bit too.
Okay, well, those are actually the titles of the series, each individual series. How are we doing on audio here?
It's good. You just got to have that thing right in your face. Is
and
all
hear myself in my head. I never titled anything of mine for maybe 20 years. And then I went back and retitled all of my work afterward.
Interesting.
Yeah, I can talk about that more later. But I don't know, to explain my work, I work a lot with found imagery and images that I take. I have for 30 plus years been sort of working with homemade special effects and post-production effects to create work that is, in the end, hopefully sort of seamless. And then when digital imaging came along, that helped in that regard.
But, Oliver, yes. Can I break this down in the most superficial way possible?
Please. Okay.
So anyway, because you know what? Oliver knows about art, and I think you guys are a bunch of morons, so that's how I'm going to put it out there, okay?
Very nice. Now that we have secured our audience.
Ah, come on. So anyway, the thing is that Oliver has this way of working. He creates these very, very fantastical, surreal images. Some of them have to do with UFOs. Oliver doesn't really believe in UFOs, but he does create these fantastical landscapes that are sort of on the border. They're surreal, border between real and not real. And then he also started taking portraits in his more recent years, right? When did you start taking portraits?
About less than 10 years ago.
Yeah, so he's been doing this over 30, whatever. And so he kind of combines his work, which is very beautiful and technically well done, but also you can't really see the technology of the Photoshop, which is what I love about it. Looks like painting. And he's got photographic portraits of people with these really dramatic backgrounds that give you a sense of there's a sadness to it. Poignancy. That's the word. That was the word. There's so poignancy? Is that cool?
Sure. I mean, they're kind of sublime or whatever. But sublime. Here's the thing. We're on the radio, so talking about what one's pictures look like on the radio is kind of silly.
I know. That's why I'm getting through this part.
Okay. So if people want to go see the show, it's like 30 plus years worth of work in the show.
Yeah.
And I would just sum it up by saying I'm interested in the intersection of painting and photography and spectacle and found images and the sublime and the sort of collision of high and low art and blah, blah, blah. So just go see the show or Google me right now.
Yeah. Just Google him or you go to my Facebook page. I have all those links. But anyway, I just want to also put in, because this is one of my personal favorites, is his Rogues Gallery. And Oliver, in my opinion, has the best, in my opinion, honestly, has the favorite work of mine about Trump and the political situation today. So I mean that. And he's done these really, why don't you describe the portraits, the Rogues Gallery, and then we'll move on.
Okay. I mean, they are fairly easy to describe because they're not very subtle. You know, they're I just after the election, I didn't really know what to do in the studio. I was kind of immobilized, so I just have been doing an ongoing series of portraits of the Trump cabinet, and they're, you know, they're just good old fashioned agitprop. You know, they're just manipulated photographs that capture the sort of decaying inner being of these people.
Yeah, they sort of have this way of expressing the personality of each individual in their own horrific but very direct way. So it's impossible to describe that at all, like the feeling you get from the pictures, but they have gotten quite a bit of notoriety. And I like them because they're very powerful, but also very subtle, in a, well, which is a weird combination.
I should also
that's point, my review of your work, Walter.
I like Oliver. It. I like it. And you can call me Walter, too.
No, you know why? Because,
Walter Robinson.
No. Walter Robinson, my father-in-law is Walter. My son,
your father-in-law is Walter Robinson?
No.
I'm learning so many
that
things
would be
about
great.
Walter.
I would love, yeah, that would be interesting. No, my father-in-law's name is Walter. All his kids have Walter in their name, and there's Walter Robinson. And I keep worrying I'm going to say your last name wrong. That's what we're talking about here. Anyway.
Just to, I should quickly add with these, you know, I didn't make these portraits, these rogue, the series, you know, they were meant to be seen online. A lot of what I do sort of intersects with social media. They were meant to be seen online. They were meant to raise money. And we have, in fact, raised a fair amount of money.
Really? For, How much?
This point, over 10,000.
Are you kidding? That's awesome.
Yeah. For, thank you, Walter Robinson, by the way. For the, and others, the ACLU and Planned Parenthood. So that was really, you know, they're not meant to be seen in a gallery in any traditional sense.
Okay, so let's talk about, what I want to do is talk about Oliver's life, his childhood, because that hasn't been discussed anywhere in this art media, and I think it's time we fucking got down to it and found out about it. One of the things that stands out, I'm just going to call this out for me, is that... I'm going to call you Walter.
Let's
Oliver.
Just call me Walter today. That's fine. Oliver. I'll call you Barbara.
So Oliver grew up with a schizophrenic brother, which I think in my field or my faux field is interesting to me. But also I think something I read when I was doing my research on Oliver is that when he started doing pictures, portraits of people, the two subjects he did first was your mother and your brother, right? And what was that, had an impact on you? How was that? How did that, what kind of impact?
Well, I had never, you know, I went almost 30 years without taking a photograph of a person for the purposes of my artwork. And I had a lot of reasons why I hadn't. But at some point, sort of born from therapy and getting older and various other things I could talk about. And mostly because I'd been collecting pictures of people, vernacular photographs of people online or digital files of people online.
Like people with their TVs. Oliver's also known for that as funny, hilarious stuff, like magic. Yeah, go ahead.
So I started to wonder why I had this separation between these kinds of pictures that I was really interested in, these vernacular old photographs of people, and my work, which was people-less, which was in and of itself was kind of an interesting thing. And I decided to take pictures of people. They're pictures that are, all, you know, they're posed in front of backdrops, and they're about sort of portraiture and painting and based on these old carte de visite kind of photographs. And the first, not the first subject, but one of the first people I photographed was my brother and my mother, because I felt like the thing that I'd always shied away with people was not wanting to sort of go for the overtly emotional, to not sort of go for that thing which is, you know, I don't have a lot of belief in photography's ability to capture the soul or to sort of speak to that part of our emotional being. So I went for something that was as emotional as possible for me, which is my brother.
And how did you feel? How did you feel, like, from looking at the photos and the process? Like, did it affect you? I mean, I'm guessing it affected you.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't get to any kind of a truth, but it gets to a truth.
Did you feel like you related to them in a new way? What was the
process? My brother and my mother?
Yeah, through taking their photographs.
No. No, I felt like I related to photography in a new way and to my work in a different way. But no, I mean, I don't think so. That's a good question, but I don't think so.
What about your photography? How did you relate to your work in a new way?
It allowed me to see that I could still be engaged with sort of things like artifice and sort of emotional distance and things like that, but also have it be directly engaged with emotion.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to describe.
Which is interesting that it's hard to describe.
Well, I'm here. Listen.
I'm making notes on this. When it's hard to describe.
Well, here's the thing. When you are asked to talk about your work, or when you sort of frame your work as an artist, very often...
Which you are a lot.
Right. Well, I guess. But very often when... What are you doing? Are you moving the microphone? You need to get closer?
Yeah, God. It's really got to be there.
Put it in my mouth.
Sorry.
is it?
Yeah. Sorry. I know. It could be awkward, but that's the way it needs to be.
Where was I?
You were telling us about...
Okay, so when you're asked to talk about your work, you are asked to often frame it in ways that I find are sort of art, you know, reference art history or reference, you know, technology or, you know, reference sort of theoretical writing. But you're not often asked to talk about it, or I didn't talk about it in terms of my personal life. And part of that is because I think people who do talk about their work in relation to their own life often do it to kind of create a mythology of the tortured artist genius.
Interesting.
And I've always had a real aversion to that, so I've shied away from it. And yet, you know, in retrospect, when I think about my relationship to my brother when I was growing up, you know, my brother got very sick when he was maybe 14, and I was 10. And I had a really long ongoing fear for much of my life of going insane also.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I am not comfortable with a lot of the connections that are made between mental illness and creativity, because I think mm-hmm. they are often over mythologized and exaggerated, it is now, as I get older, I allow myself to sort of mm-hmm. allow for that a little bit more. Mm-hmm. I've been sort of looking at that again.
Oh, well, there's a lot of growth in that.
And I think that when you deal with something like schizophrenia, where you have a separation between, we have a disconnect from reality, that parallels photography in some ways, or my interest in photography, which is something that I've always been interested in, the sort of the schizophrenic relationship that photography has to reality. You know,
right.
It is both a trace of it and it's not. You know, and at the same time, it isn't reality itself. So, you know, I'd always been interested in those kind of otherworldly spaces and that weird sort of hyperreal disconnect between reality and fiction. And then I started to look at it in terms of not just my brother's illness, but more specifically my fear of losing my mind or my fear of not having a grasp on reality. Hey, can I ask you a question? Is it possible to turn the headphones down? That's
down?
Part of the problem with
yeah.
talking.
Yeah, okay, sure.
I mean, that doesn't turn it down for
yeah,
them, right?
Yeah, I can't hear through. You have your own thing. Is that better? So
it's that's way better.
Thank way you. Better? Yeah. yeah. I'm glad you asked.
Oh, even much better.
Okay. Oh, good. I'm so
that
happy.
Was the problem with getting so close because I couldn't hear myself.
All right. Well, you know, we have a full-service studio here, yeah. and the headphones are on different controls.
The shrimp, so, the shrimp cocktail is fantastic.
Is it really good? The green room stuff, right?
Yeah, no.
I don't know. Amazing. And did you like the welcoming marching band that we had for you?
I'm not a fan of Sousa, but it was.
It was nice, though, right? They practiced a long time for that. So,
thank you.
But I think it would be really interesting. I mean, I want to hear. I want to hear this here. Let's start at the beginning. So, where did you grew up in Wisconsin? Tell us about where you grew up.
I grew up in a town called Middleton, Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
Which was a very small town outside of Madison, Wisconsin, which was a small town in terms of population, but a college town, so sort of urban in its own way.
You and your brother was 4 years older. Did you have other siblings?
I do. I have a very complicated family. That brother is, we share a mother, but not a father.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a sister with whom I share a mother, but not a father. And I grew up with both of them and always thought of them as being my, you know, full brothers, even though they're technically half.
So you...
And then I have two other brothers who are much older than I am, who I share a father with.
And you didn't grow up with them?
I did not, though. I'm very close.
So this is way beyond my pay grade to understand all this. So I just want to get a picture of who were the people that you were in the house with. That's so... So you have...
I was in the house with my father.
Mm-hmm. Your real father.
My biological father, who was 50 years old when I was born. He was a mathematician, taught at the University of Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother, my biological mother, who was 26 years old when I was born. So there's 24 years difference.
Oh, wow. Was she a babe? I had to ask that.
Yeah, you can ask it, but I can't answer it. That's above my pay grade.
All right.
I can't go there.
I'm picturing it, though.
And they were temperamentally very different. I mean, they were both very sort of secular Jews, but my father was a mathematician. My mother was a social worker.
Uh-huh. Was there a yarmulke wearing at home?
There's no yarmulke wearing at home. We celebrated Christmas. My father was a German Jew. He fled the Nazis.
Yeah, really?
In the 30s, yeah.
Wow, as a child, but, right? But
no, he was born in 1909.
Oh, wow.
So he was,
right, yeah.
When Hitler came to power, he was, you know, already in his early 20s.
Wow.
And, he came to the States, sort of, he got out just in time.
Wow.
And heavy. So, yeah, no, he was born before World War One.
So what was their dynamic like?
What was my parents' dynamic like? Well, they were very, I have very happy memories of their marriage up until I was about 10, and then things increasingly got less happy.
So when your brother started getting sick, that must have changed everything, right, for everybody. Is that so?
Yeah, and he got sick right at the, you know, we were in a college town. It was the late 60s, early 70s. There were riots in town.
Oh, really?
All the time, and just the whole fucking world was.
Did it seem dangerous to live there because of that rioting atmosphere and all that? Was because, you know,
I didn't feel in danger myself. My father was the head of the math department during from like 68 to 72, and during that time, the Army Math Research Center there was blown up, and a couple of people were killed. When he was the chair of the department. So we actually went for a year to Switzerland. He got a job teaching in Zurich.
Did that scare you? Was that sort of frightening when that happened?
No.
So you weren't really affected by that. Were you affected by your other half brothers and sisters floating around, those other families and stuff like that? Was that affecting you?
No, I had like these two older brothers who, you know, one of them is 16 years older than me, one of the other ones 14 years older than me, and they would visit us on holidays. And it was
just like having uncles.
It was
really,
yeah, like having uncles. No, I loved them. They were great.
So what was your life like before your brother got sick up until 10? Like,
it was, you know.
Was it like, were you like a freak in a small town? I hear that a lot from people.
It was a very small town. It was a farming town, and it was a very, very Lutheran town, as Wisconsin is can be. And we were Jews, and although we were secular Jews, we were Jews, you know, and I felt like that famous scene in that Woody Allen movie where he goes back to Wisconsin, actually in Annie Hall, and he's got like the,
right.
What are they called? Pay us. Thank you. See, that's what my kids often make fun of me for being such a failed Jew. I don't even know when penises, but I felt very Jewish when I was growing up. Like mm-hmm. I would say things like I don't believe in God and stuff on the, which isn't necessarily Jewish. That's more atheist. But I would, you know, we were very different. We were very different than the mm-hmm. Lutheran mm-hmm. Wisconsin mm-hmm. people.
So you were aware of that, and were you like good in? Were you interested in anything in particular? Were you a sports kid? Were you art,
no,
drawing,
definitely
writing?
Definitely not an art kid. I mean, I was one of those kids. I did okay in school up until fifth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And then I kind of just started, then I just dropped out, basically. I didn't mm-hmm. do well in anything. And, you know, I was one of those kids where the teachers would always say, you know, Oliver is so smart. He has such potential. If you would just apply himself. And I remember thinking like, oh, okay, you know I'm smart, then I don't need to prove it to you. And
I love that self-contained.
But no, I mean, you know, what really happened was around fifth grade is when my brother started to get mm-hmm. sick. And,
so what happened? What was that like? How did it show up? You know, that's a really horrible, mysterious illness.
Well, for him, schizophrenia manifests in a very young age, which in sort of the younger you are, the more severe it is. And he really mm-hmm. he's quite sick and still is. But of course this was at the height of the sort of Ken Kesey, you know, who's crazy, them or us? You know, the one flew over the cuckoo's nest kind of thing. So, and there were a lot of drugs being taken by him and by everyone.
Yeah.
And so my mother who, you know, so when my brother started acting crazy, very crazy, she's getting like, you know, psychiatrists telling her, well, you know, you need to hug him more, love him more, whatever the fuck the psychiatrist did around that time, and denying that he was sick. And it wasn't, and of course they had all these deinstitutionalization, I guess that came later, but yeah, it was impossible to, he's walking around barefoot in the middle of, you know, sub-zero weather, living in caves, going to northern Wisconsin to liberate the Indians, and you know, just all this stuff.
Did he?
And mm-hmm. Psychiatrists are just saying, like, you know, he needs psychotherapy, when obviously what he needed was to be institutionalized and put on drugs. So it was a number of years until they finally got him to be.
So what would happen was it like he? Did he run away from home? Did he start not sleeping? Did he, like, was it sudden or was it all, or like what happened at home? Like how did everybody cope with that? Like
just chaos. I mean, no,
was there a lot of arguing or what was your role? Was it staying out of the way?
I started by saying that they just didn't understand him. And then I saw a few real psychotic episodes.
Uh-huh.
And at one point when I was 13 years old, I went out to California actually to live with my older brother because I needed to get out of the house. My parents wanted me out of the house because
age 13.
Yeah.
Why?
Because there was just too much chaos in the house. There was a point where they were trying to get him institutionalized, and my brother kindly offered to put me up for a year in Palo Alto. So I went up.
Your older brother, right?
Yeah, because he's
like uncle. I was 13. Brother.
I went to live with my brother, who was 27 at the time.
Oh, yeah.
And he and his wife were, you know, she was pregnant with their first kid. And so I lived there.
Was that nice?
Well,
how did you feel about it?
It was nice for me. I think it was hell for them. I'm very grateful that they did it. I was a very difficult child.
Really? Why? Yeah. What did you do?
I was taking a lot of drugs and very involved in a lot of, I was acting out.
So at age 13, wow. Well, I guess I can understand that. You know, that's a difficult background that you were from, but did you feel unsupervised maybe? Did you feel like kind of independent while you were there? Like you could do it, get away with more?
I thought I would. And then when I got there, I realized it was actually just the opposite. My brother's wife was like, she took no bullshit.
Good for her.
Yeah.
In the long run, right?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah. So it was just like chaos around your house. I don't mean to like pry or But I'm just trying to picture it, and it's frankly, I mean, my father had a severe depression, and he walked around for a time without bathing or talking or sleeping, and you know, just in his bathrobe. So I mean, I've seen that, but I don't think this is what you're talking about is very different. So can you give us more of an idea? I'm trying to imagine it. It's very hard to imagine.
I mean, it's, you know, it's very hard for me to separate it all from the time, from that early 70s time. I mean, the world was just like going crazy then.
Right.
With like the SLA and it's Watergate.
Well, there was a lot of violence and craziness.
And just helter skelter and stuff. So in some ways, in my mind, in retrospect, it was all under that umbrella and then filtered through a haze of drugs from my perspective, right? So in terms of his behavior, you know, I was 13 years old. All I wanted was to like just, you know, I wasn't conscious of what that meant.
Right.
I have a lot of, I have looked back on it. And I have a lot of feelings about it in retrospect that are ever shifting. You know, they're constantly shifting.
At the time, it was just the world is crazy.
At the time, it was just like, here's another kid, you know, barefoot, talking about, you know, talking about the classic, you know, paranoid schizophrenic hallucinations. And he was having a lot of audio and visual hallucinations, and he was... basically, you know, I mean, we all see schizophrenics every day on the street.
We do, yeah.
They're usually self-medicated.
A lot of people don't understand that.
On the train ride down here, I was up in the Poughkeepsie train station before I came down here, just this building has these incredible acoustics, and there was a schizophrenic woman sitting on the bench in there, because it's cold out, talking loudly to herself for an hour, and we all just sat there while she did it.
Sure.
So, you know, with our mental health laws the way there are many, many self-medicated and unmedicated schizophrenics everywhere. And so that's what it was like. It was like living with.
And you said you were taking a lot of drugs. So what kind of, like, what were you doing? What was your life like?
I mean, for me, I had most of my drug use, you know, other than pot and alcohol, really was between like 13 and 17. And, you know, just
meaning like a lot of acid.
Yeah. Which is a really strange thing because I would take acid and always have a bad trip. Always.
Yeah. It's intense.
I mean, I never enjoyed it and I would keep taking it. And if I was in the country, I'd be okay. I still didn't enjoy it. But if I was in the country, at least I was like, I felt less paranoid.
It's scary.
It's horrible. It's a horrible drug. Although I've been reading a lot of stuff recently and hearing a lot of stuff recently about how it's now being
used,
re-studied in controlled ways, particularly for people who have terminal cancer and stuff. I still don't understand why, when I had this total obsessive 24-hour-a-day fear of losing my mind, why I took acid, and it had to have something to do with this weird, I mean, there was a peer pressure thing, I think, but it also had to have something to do with this weird relationship I had to my brother and wanting to sort of, I don't know.
Were you trying to was he hard to understand? Were you trying to understand him?
You know, again, I could only, one can speculate.
Yeah, one can only,
at the time, you know, at the time I can say that for many, many years after I quit all other drugs, I continued to smoke pot and drink. And I smoked pot like every day, all day until I was about 30. And never smoked it in public with anybody ever. Only smoked it in my studio. And I would get very high and my work would look so fucking good. And I would just think like, oh, I'm a genius. And then I'd come down, I'd have to get high again. And I was afraid to stop smoking pot. Because even though it made me very paranoid, like I said, I did it alone, so I was okay. But I was afraid to stop smoking pot because I thought that it allowed me to access that in-between space that I'm interested in my work, that kind of hallucinatory album cover sort of 13-year-old adolescent boy space that I was interested in. I haven't taken any drugs since in almost 30 years, not since I was 30, but of any kind. But that was that relationship to pushing myself to the brink of insanity with drugs is something that I continued to do for a long time after I quit taking acid.
Did you have a lot of friends? Were you part of a group of people that were all taking drugs together?
Yeah, I had that middle school thing where I felt like the outsider. All the jocks were doing what they were doing and stuff in seventh grade. And, you know, it was just like I was miserable. And then I discovered drugs and I suddenly had tons of friends.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's probably a big encouragement to take drugs for sure. Sure. And actually, in a certain way, I think it's good that you kind of were able to handle that, because a lot of people could have just become total loners. And, you know, I mean, you were part of a community, which is always a healthy thing.
I don't know if it's always a healthy thing.
Well, I don't know. It seems to have worked out one way or the other. But because now you are you've been happily married. I just want, don't feel bad for Oliver. You've been happily married for how long?
Feel bad for me.
You have two children. One's two teenage children. You've been happily married for how long?
I've been happily, very happily married for, I've been with my wife, Dana Hoey, since 2001 and married since 2004. And we've got a 16-year-old and a 14-year-old.
Yeah, there you go. And she's a very well-respected artist. So I'm saying, folks, whatever, and he's got a great, what I think of as a great art career. Don't feel bad for him. This is not so, I mean, he did okay. So how did your parents manage you when your brother got sick? Like what happened? How did they relate? How did they handle that as far as being your parents?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, one can only look at this stuff in retrospect, years of therapy and stuff. And as now that I have my own kids, I certainly have much more sympathy for them. You know, when you're 13 years old, it's like, and again, I didn't consciously think this at the time. In retrospect, I sort of realized like, hello, you know, I'm over here. A little attention, please. You know, like. I didn't feel it at the time, consciously. Mm-hmm. But I assume that was a big part of my childhood, was like, you know, my brother consumed all energy, all attention was on him because he was because he was ill. Yeah. So how they handled it, I don't know. Their marriage didn't last. You know, they divorced when I was 17 and probably would have divorced much sooner had they not stayed together for me, I guess. I don't know. I don't know what caused their marriage.
So you were clearly in the background. Is that, it doesn't sound like you had a lot of conflict with them.
Oh, I did have a lot of conflict with them. Tons of conflict.
Really?
Fighting,
like what?
Constant fighting all day, 24/7.
About what? Did they know you were taking drugs?
I don't know.
Well, what would they fight
about?
Which
baffles me that I don't know that.
Interesting.
What did we fight about?
Yeah, you were in conflict with your parents.
Yeah. With my mother, mostly. I don't know. Like, just.
Did you resent them? Do you remember how you felt towards them?
No.
Been in therapy?
Yeah, I don't believe in that kind of therapy. I mean, I believe in it, but
no,
I don't.
That's all right.
I mean, yes.
It's interesting.
Here's the thing about therapy. You go to therapy to knock your parents off a pedestal, right?
Well, I don't know if I necessarily agree with that, but that's a whole other conversation.
All right. Well, for me, that's what I did. And then slowly try to put them back out.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm feeling sorry for your mom right now for some reason. That must have been fucking tough, man.
Well, and that's the thing, is it's like, it's not until I had kids of my own that I was really allowed myself to have more than a kind of intellectual understanding of feeling sorry for
No, me. I mean, it's really, really, what you went through is really, really tough. And however it processed, it's impressive. However it processed pretty well. But, so I'm just like, did your parents realize it was schizophrenia? How long, like that it was it's a physical illness, right? Mm-hmm. So when did they realize it was a physical illness?
It was diagnosed fairly early. After that first sort of, you know,
episode,
6 months of like, you know, you just need to, he's just acting out. It's the 60s, whatever, you know, when he really started to clearly be having hallucinations and was in risk of losing his life and had to be institutionalized.
Right.
Then it was called schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm. And did you see violence at home?
No.
Okay. You talked about your fear of going crazy, which I can understand. Can you like tell me a little bit more about that, like how that developed and how it you know integrated into your life? Like, what was that like?
Well, I mean, it continues in some ways in that I wrestle with anxiety and stuff like that. But
did you worry that your children were going to inherit that or anything?
No,
like that?
Schizophrenia is a actually. And I found this out rather late in life. I knew that it was a genetic...
Chromosomes.
I knew it was genetic. And so that was had a lot to do with my fear of going crazy. What I didn't know is that it comes from your father's side of the family.
Oh.
And my brother and I don't share a father.
Oh. I wish you'd known that on day one. Maybe. Don't worry. Listen, guys. Right. We got this. It's, when did you develop the fear? Was it early on after he's, I mean, it sounds like a normal way to respond to something like that. Or what's that fear about? What's that like having to live with that?
Well, it's very hard for me to separate it from the drug use because, like I said, I was taking these drugs that pushed me to the brink but I was also, you know, I had a lot of panic attacks. And if you've ever had a panic attack, you know that one of the manifestations of panic attack is a kind of disassociative thing. You leave your body in some ways. And I would have these panic attacks, and I don't know, in retrospect, I think some of them might have been flashbacks also, but I would have these panic attacks where I felt like I was separated from my body. And I think that that's how I understood mental illness, was a kind of, it's when your brain betrays you.
Interesting.
So like if your brain is suddenly seeing shit that's not there, hearing stuff that's not there, that's like a betrayal. That's a separation of what your brain is supposed to do, which is, you know, your input is supposed to be what's actually happening out there, and then you can correspond to it. So, you know, and you know, strangely, my fear of losing my mind was usually a social fear also. I was afraid that I would act out in some way.
Like your brother?
You mean maybe, I don't know. I mean, to this day, like I can't fly without Xanax or Avitan or something like that. Mm-hmm. And part of the fear, it's like, I know the plane's not going
down.
Yeah, right. Right? That's like, I know the plane isn't gonna crash. The fear is I'm in a small little box, I have claustrophobia too, but I'm in a small little box and you're 35,000 feet up in the air. And if you suddenly start going, fucking let me out of here, or going crazy, you know, they put you in a straitjacket or whatever they do. So my fear is more like the fear of losing control.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that all of the sort of anxiety that issues I've dealt with in my life have been about that fear of disassociating from reality, of losing control.
Mm-hmm.
It's like I'm a Jew talking about this stuff. I got to mention Woody Allen again in this Me Too moment. Despite this, Woody Allen.
Yeah, separate the art and the artist. Sure.
There's a scene where, and I don't know, a lot of people don't remember, it was Christopher Walken, but I think it's also in Annie Hall, where they're in a car and Christopher Walken is driving and he's like, he's a vet, he's come back from the war or something, and he's talking about how he has a fear of turning the car into the oncoming headlights.
Right, yeah.
And that, I think, really perfectly describes it. It's like, all you got to do is drive.
Right.
But it's like if I drive up Highway 1 in California, I can do it going upstate. I can't do it going downstate. I can't do it going south because I'm on the ocean side.
Uh-huh.
And you know that all you have to do is go and you can just kill yourself, right? I mean, I'm not suicidal. I don't have a desire to kill myself.
Right.
But it's like, and that's why, you know, I have a fear of heights also. It's like, there's like 1 inch between me and death. It's like that, I can't control, I can't handle that responsibility.
I imagine seeing, did you talk about your brother with your friends or did you keep that private out of the house?
I think I kept it private. I actually remember, and this is a an awful thing to admit to, but you know, I had this group of friends in high school, and there was this kid, Bob, I can't remember his last name, and he clearly had schizophrenia, like in retrospect, especially, I realized that. And he would take drugs with us and stuff, and he would really, like, just, he would be laughing to himself.
Oh,
it's just like, I mean, he was really, it was really scary stuff. And we would make fun of him.
Oh.
You know, I just remember making fun of him. And I remember, like, thinking, yeah, it's like, I don't, you know, kids are like, when you're 15, 16 years old, it takes, you know, a special kind of kid. I had great empathy. I was a wonderful kid. But when you get a group of kids together, it's like, you don't sit, despite what they might tell you in the movies, and maybe kids have changed now too, but I don't know. We didn't sit around and talk about our feelings.
Right.
And,
well, and it's stuff. Also really scary for a bunch of kids to see that. And that's probably the best coping mechanism any kid could have. So I can understand that, but it sounds like,
although just interrupt, I see my kids now and and I don't know what they do when they're not around me, but I think they would be better than that. Like, I think actually that, there is more of a
social consciousness now.
Yeah.
Well, that's because there are kids from our generation. Our generation is their parents, and we're more socially conscious too, I think. Well, I can see how that would be really scary because, I mean, to grow up with, you know, your brother in the sense that he was capable of behavior that you didn't really see anywhere else and you couldn't really talk about it, or, you know, you probably didn't have the tools to describe it. So it could probably just get all, you know, integrate, you know, you kind of internalized a lot of it, I think, maybe, you know, because you couldn't really discuss it with anybody. And it was really, really frightening. And we're not allowed to, boys can't say they're scared, right? And
I guess, I just seem more like it was also... just there's always this feeling of like, so is he gonna get better? Is he gonna get better? And then at some point you realize like, okay, he's not getting better. And then it becomes, he's a really sweet man. And I really, you know, I the amount of, I just can't describe how bad I feel for him. I mean, it's kind of, I mean, that's the sort of overriding thing. It's just like nothing can be done. But it's also like on a selfish level, when you're with somebody that you can't talk to, and I can't really carry on much of a conversation with my brother, that's hard. And it's just, sometimes it's easier just to avoid it. And that's and then you feel guilty and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, because it's really profoundly painful to live with that. It is. I mean, we all have different things, but that's a big one.
Yeah, and there's a huge space between who you want to see yourself as and who you are.
Yeah, I don't think there's any way that you can really square that living with somebody like that unless, you know, I mean, there's just no, what are you going to do, give up your entire life to, you know, I mean, I can't imagine.
There are people who do. I mean, there are people who you know, fight the good fight and show up and stuff. And it's,
I don't know if that's, you know, if that, who would make that choice? I don't know. I mean, I don't even know if that's a healthy choice, but that is a really difficult, really difficult situation. And I wanted to get into, we had sort of talked a little bit about this before we got on the air, and we're kind of running out of time now, sadly. We only have 11 minutes left, but I did want to see if we could touch on how it affects how, We were starting to talk about how you've become a little more, I think, emotionally aware lately, and how your emotions and your work sort of are more conscious for you. Is that a good way to put it, what we were talking about?
Maybe. I mean, I think
However we put it, you know what I'm saying.
I do.
Let's talk about that. You tell me.
Well, and I made reference to it earlier. I think that, and it may be just a byproduct of getting older too. I'm more interested now in kind of looking back and looking at my work from a perspective that is less about art history and about critical theory, and more about, which a lot of people do from the get-go. I mean, this is sort of my failing, I think, in some ways, and looking at it more in terms of the stuff that we're talking about now, and framing it in terms of my inner life.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was thinking about that because I can imagine like a way for you to cope with what happened with your brother is to try to distance yourself. But I think like in your work, you've sort of come. Well, what really struck me was when I was reading, I was doing my research on you, was that it was very sudden when you started combining your kind of landscape type work and your portraiture work. And it was very conscious on your mm-hmm. part. And I think I was thinking that there was some resistance from you to accessing some of your emotions, which I think is which you probably had to develop. So maybe you're more comfortable doing that now, or they're bleeding together more. Or
I mean, I can frame it in a bigger picture in terms of sort of the cultural condition of sarcasm and cynicism and irony and distance. Mm-hmm. All of these things that I grew up with that were a huge part of my early adolescence, as we went from the sort of hippie period, which was, you know, my brother's period, and how I defined myself as a 16-year-old in 1976, 70, you know, 15 years old in 75, was Velvet Underground, Patti Smith, the Ramones, and, you know, Sex Pistols, things that were, you know, art, but they were very much about a kind of, or maybe Warhol is a much better example. Mm-hmm. Warhol was like a lifeboat for me, mm-hmm. life jacket for me, because there was this kind of like, it was really smart and really like important art, but it was all about surface and veneer mm-hmm. and spectacle mm-hmm. and distance and all of these things that worked very well for me at a time when I probably just didn't want to deal with, you know, reality. And they were also, you know, were a cultural condition that exists to this day. We got fucking Trump as president. I mean, the ultimate sort of dystopian, you know, reality. We have a reality TV star as a president. So this kind of Warholian sort of tradition continues, unfortunately. But I think as one starts to see the downside to that, and as one gets older and has kids themselves, and you start to see, okay, irony can be a defense, and it can be, it's great, or sarcasm, or whatever, you know, it's great. I think it's really important. Sincerity mm-hmm. kills things, you know, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. it can kill sure. things. But I think as I get older, as I have kids of my own and stuff, I am trying to find that point at which those things can intersect more. And actually, I think that's one of the things that made Warhol so good, as opposed to a lot of the sort of Warholian pretenders, is that sure, it was about irony and distance and coolness, but it was a fucking electric chair, right? So it was about the death penalty, and it was about very real things. It was about race riots, and, you know, so it's finding that point where the real and the artificial intersect, or where genuine feeling and, you know, that sort of shield you put up around yourself intersect mm-hmm. is where I'm at. Mm-hmm. I think where I've been moving more in that direction of, like, yes, I'm interested in spectacle. I'm interested in, you know, things that are sort of very cool and distanced and everything, but it's, mm-hmm. I want to find the heat in that as well. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so for me, like, to get back to this picture of my brother, for me, it was a way of saying to my brother, you know, I'm going to present you, and I'm with this permission and everything, as this kind of, you know, my picture of him isn't a classic sort of, you know, I'm going to go into an insane asylum and take a picture of a crazy person and get pathos from you, or, you know, make a sort of Diane Arbus spectacle out of it. It's more about, like, can you actually penetrate this? There is so much real emotion there, and, like, mm-hmm, yes. the inability of a picture to actually provide you with that. And it does for me. I look at that picture and it moves me a great deal. And at the same time, it's not him. You know, it's mm-hmm. so yeah, so that's.
And it's in your show now. That is the picture of your
mother. It's the only portrait.
Right?
Those two, I did a show of portraits at Stephanie. And those are the only two I put in. Otherwise, everything in the show is older work. And from the 80s, in fact, the picture of my brother is next to one of the first pieces I did, which I did in 1983, mm-hmm. which is just called Flash, which is just a flash mm-hmm. of light. In a pure perspective kind of thing. Which looks like a nuclear explosion, which mm-hmm. a little bit, which for me, nuclear explosions are the ultimate example of this, like, unimaginable horror and beauty at the same time.
Right.
The sublime. You
know? Yeah. Yeah. And we haven't, this planet hasn't seen one in like 40, I mean, I don't know. It's crazy. It is. It's so freaky to even think about. Yeah. Think about that. Do you think having kids changed? I mean, how did that change you?
Having kids changed everything.
I mean, you know, we're focused on, you know, your work and your your emotional state and the relationship between your emotional state and your work. Mm-hmm. So how did that change? Or like, what did that?
I mean, it's all part of what I was just talking about. I think it's like, you cannot have children and retain the level of misanthropic, cynical, sarcastic, ironic. I just keep throwing, you know, I know these are different words, but I kind of throw them into the bag together. You just can't hold on to that stuff. It's like,
because
I mean, you can't.
No, but I mean, like, I have a stepson who I always say I love dearly, which I do. He's getting married in May.
Congratulations.
But I never had kids. So, and did your relationship to being in a family change because you had a trouble? Let's say you had a troubled family and now you have your own family. Mm-hmm. It was yours. Is that a big part of it or something like that?
I don't know how to say it except it's, you know, it's sounding corny or something, but it's like, you know, I met my wife and it was like, you know, I fell in love.
Uh-huh.
Am in love. Had kids, and that's a love that's like a different, even a whole different kind of love where, you know, it's like, for me, it was like, oh, that's why I'm here, you know.
So it gave your life a certain meaning and
it gave my life meaning.
Meaning in a way that
for me, and I would have had. I never planned to have kids. You know, I didn't think, and then I wanted to, and I'm very glad that I did. And I think if I hadn't, my life would have had great meaning also.
Mm-hmm.
But as it is, having had kids, that is where much of the meaning of my life, you know, is. Mm-hmm. My life is understood at this point.
Mm.
In relation to, and it's not a burden I put on them, hopefully.
No.
I'm just saying my life is understood now in terms of like something very basic and
your family biological. Doesn't show up in your work literally a lot, does it?
No, I've got like a lot of pictures of my wife and my kids in my work.
Why am I missing that? I don't know.
Two pictures of my wife in my last show, two of my daughter, one of my son.
So they are.
Yeah, I mean, probably more than they would like to be. And to be honest, I do it more because they're there and I can photograph them.
Yeah, because you've always liked photographing people you know, family and friends, or at least that's how you started.
Yeah, again,
right?
I think in some ways it's more just because I hate taking photographs of people. I don't enjoy the process of doing it. So if it's somebody I know, it's easier.
Oh, I mean, you don't like what is like the whole, like, do you feel like, what do you feel like they're doing you a favor? Sit there, do this, do that.
I'm always afraid. I mean, I think probably a lot of photographers can relate to this. I'm afraid I'm going to spend 2 hours photographing them and then realize I forgot to put in the car, or the lighting sucks, or it's just like my, you know, for me, photographs are something that's one of the reasons I don't really like taking photographs. I much prefer finding them.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
It's just like the act of actually taking a picture doesn't interest me that
much. A lot of pressure.
Yeah.
Kind of like, you know, like, oh, sorry, we forgot to record the show or something like that. Right. I get it.
Exactly.
We have 1 minute left. You know, that I just wanted to say how powerful that portrait of your brother is and how, like, it's very, very complicated and undefinable, the emotion that you get from it, but it's very, very powerful. And I'm going to encourage everybody to see the show before April 22nd. And it's at 56 Bogart Street. That's at Theodore R. Check my Facebook page for the information on the upcoming book launch of Friends, Enemies, and Strangers. And I also want to put in another big plug to make sure that everybody goes to the show tonight. You got to go to the show at the Well, okay? And stay tuned because my good friend Ilan Danziger is up. He's hilarious and funny. He plays great music. Lost and Rewound is on right after this.